This is not the sermon I set out to write. But here it is. Once upon a time, this is what I believed. There is no difficulty that enough love will not conquer, no disease that enough love will not heal, no door that enough love will not open, no gulf that enough love will not bridge, no wall that enough love will not throw down, no sin that enough love will not redeem. It matters no difference how deeply seated may be the trouble, how hopeless the outlook, how muddled the tangle, how great the mistake. A sufficient realization of love will dissolve it all. If only you could love enough, you would be the happiest and most powerful being in the world. I found these words by Emmett Fox collected in a little book called The Language of Love, which I acquired when I was 16. Back then, I had no idea who Emmett Fox was, but that didn't matter. The words were good, and I believed in them with all the fervent idealism of my youth. As a credo, the whole thing seemed pure and simple. It covered everything I thought anyone would ever encounter going through life. If only everyone could love enough, all the big problems, be sure to always capitalize the B and the P when I say this, in your mind, all the big problems of the world could be resolved. All the things idealistic teenagers of the late 1970s discussed around campfires during church youth retreats. You know, now capitalize all of these too. World peace, especially between the Irish and Irish Protestants and Catholics, ending world hunger, ending poverty, the energy crisis, stopping pollution, and curing cancer. All the things that loomed large and distressing in my growing awareness of the world, but were mostly remote for my stable, two-parent, middle-class life in 97% white Waukesha, Wisconsin. Away from the campfire, I didn't know very many other idealists. I was a weird kid who spent my study period in the library hand-copying vegetarian recipes from cookbooks or reading about the uses of native plants, and my lunch hour in the art room throwing pots, and that's art jargon for making them, not breaking them. I preferred spending Friday nights listening to records on headphones to going to football games. I preferred wandering through the woods to shopping at the mall. As soon as it warmed up in spring, I kicked off my shoes to walk home from school barefoot, trotting through puddles still rimmed with ice. When it got warmer, I sat out on the school lawn, writing in my journal, and not for a class assignment. That was weird. My closest friend in 10th and 11th grade, the first real-life atheist I had ever met, dubbed me Mrs. Thoreau after we read Walden in English class. We bonded over our shared taste in album rock and our cynicism about the mess religion and politics had made of the world so far. As we saw it, every new paragraph in our U.S. history textbook chronicled another war, another invasion, another act of destruction, further proof that power corrupts. Lacking power ourselves, we were still relatively uncorrupted, of course. It gratified my ego to be linked, even if only in the mind of one other person, with Thoreau. When the question, what are you going to do after high school, came up, as of course it always does for you when you're in high school, I was ready with a curmudgeonly answer worthy of Henry David himself. Become a hermit. It was not that I enjoyed my own company so much, but that other people were so annoying and hard to talk to, especially when I tried to bring up the things I cared about. Adults, of course, saw it as their duty to set me straight about reality, which I refused to believe in, capital R reality, of course. But almost anyone else with a strong opposing viewpoint could take me to pieces in a matter of seconds. Becoming cheerful weakened my argument even more. And anyway, the time I spent alone was not so much in my own company as the company of pines and oaks and birds and grasses and running streams, you know, so on. I was a romantic cynic. I was in the company of songwriters and musicians. I was in the company of people who wrote passionately about things I was curious about, people who created interesting fictional worlds. I was happily occupied, learning to recognize and name and befriend all these wondrous things. But since I had to do something after high school and becoming a hermit was not an option, I did the next best thing and enrolled in college as a perpetually undecided major. None of the career options that were available perfectly fit my interests or my hazy vision of how I might be of service in the world while also being happy. Even though I was cynical, I still cared about the big problems of the world. But now I understood how ridiculous their scope was, how immense and intractable they were. Too many people who were way smarter and way more imaginative than me had dedicated their whole lives to the big problems without much lasting effect. The world was full of gaping wounds. And as quickly as some people worked to close them, other people were only too eager to rip them open again. What was wrong with people? There was so much loose talk about love in mainstream culture, but very little evidence of it in people's behavior. Plus, I'd soon found out in my personal relationships that love was far from being a magical elixir that could unmuddle the other person's tangles or bridge even minor gaps of understanding. The love I thought I needed to unmuddle my own tangles also seemed in short supply. After 5.5 years, I surrendered and took a degree in the subject I had the most credits in. I put my diploma in a drawer and shortly thereafter took up the work, the task of raising children, which occupied me for 20 more years. During those years, I tried to live out my values through the things I taught them, how I spent time and money. I pulled wages from a bunch of odd jobs. We joined this church. I volunteered. The 20 years went by in a flash. Just wait. You who have young children. My children were out the door, living their own lives, and the question, now what, had come around again. I was suddenly old and nowhere near half perfect halfway into my life, not even one quarter perfect. And the world was in pretty much the same state, the same old big problems plus a bunch of new ones. Not a slim fraction of perfect, several zeros to the right of the decimal point perfect. And I was just as clueless as ever about any kind of work I could put my heart into. Come to think of it, I hadn't checked in with my heart in a long time. Was it still beating? A while back, I had the opportunity to see Monet's Water Lilies at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. Has anyone else seen it there? So it's made up of several large panels that hang in their own alcove. And the alcove is bigger than the space back here. The panels are huge. And there are benches in the alcove, so you can sit there and be more or less surrounded by this painting. The flowers are larger than life. And apparently Monet intended it, designed it this way. So it's really striking if you've only ever seen the water lilies on an umbrella or a notebook cover. And especially because coming through the museum the way we went through, we also saw Van Gogh's Starry Night, which is about the size of you see it when you see it in a poster. And then you come on water lilies, and they're huge. So I encountered Robert Hayden's poem some years later. The first time I read it, I burst into tears. So this is some bothersome occurrence that's been happening to me for a while now. It plagues me. It's not unusual. I don't like to admit it because it seems sentimental, but it's part of the story. So I've learned that when that happens, it usually signifies that some important truth is at hand, even if it's not always glaringly obvious to me in the moment what it is. So I penciled a star next to the title, and I underlined, "O light, beheld us through refracted tears." Sometimes I revisit a poem that I've starred like that and I wonder what the heck I ever saw in it. But this poem haunted me in this particular line from this poem. At first, I thought it had to do with the potential for heartbreak in caring deeply about something. But that seemed to have more to do with loss, which didn't quite fit. So I puzzled over this and searched my memory of the painting for clues. And one night, just as my head hit the pillow, I suddenly knew what it was. It was the juxtaposition of beauty and suffering in the poem. The serene great picture, side by side with the images of violence evoked by Selma and Saigon. All you had to do was change the names to ones from any other given day in any other given decade, and you had those same old sorrowful big problems again. But at last, I understood the reason for my endless floundering. I'd never been able to come to terms with this world in which beauty and suffering exist side by side, particularly when most of the suffering is perpetrated by one human being on another. My joy, so long ago, had been in all the things that were beautiful to me, but at some point, I'd stopped allowing myself to love them. I was afraid not so much of losing them, but that I did not deserve them somehow. Maybe because so many other people in the world were less fortunate than me, or maybe for some other convoluted reason that I don't understand yet. This is still the forming edge of a new awareness. But even before this, I was already sitting uncomfortably with some other unlovely truths about myself. First, how mindlessly I fall into us versus them thinking. Second, all the stereotypes I've harbored and never bothered to examine because they were to do with people whose behavior I blamed for all the big problems, or people who, in my judgment, only cared about things I thought were either wrong or unimportant. I'd always thought of myself as a person on the right side of all the important things in life, as if that meant I was loving. And look what it had done to me. I was shocked by how disconnected my mind and heart had become. And worse, so many of my actions were motivated by fear. Poet W.S. Merwin says, "I needed my mistakes in their own order to get me here." Folk singer Carrie Newcomer puts it this way: "What would I change if the choice were mine? I was doing the best I knew at the time." Was I? It's not my usual habit of mind to think so. But something inside me had started to shift. In her book, Rising Strong, Brené Brown says the most compassionate people, the ones she calls wholehearted, believe that most people are doing the best they can most of the time, including themselves. The ones who don't believe this are the perfectionists and the purists, the people who hold themselves and others to impossible standards. Perfectionists say, "I know I'm not doing my best, so of course no one else is." Wholehearted people say, "Well, all I know for sure is that my life is better when I assume other people are doing their best. It keeps me out of judgment and lets me focus on what is, not what should or could be." It takes courage and patience to hold open a judgment-free space for ourselves and other people. But the inner work of changing our own hearts is where the work of loving the world begins. Standing still, learning to be astonished, is nothing more than this: stopping to pay attention, noticing what we see, noticing what we hear, and noticing what we feel. We don't have to understand it right away. Only trust that we will, in time, learn to identify life-giving responses and solutions for the difficulties we encounter. Love, I'm coming to believe, is less a feeling, less an ideal, and less even a direct action than a way of being present. Or perhaps simply it is being present, fully present. Whether we're talking about being present to our experiences and emotions or being fully present to another person, when our heart and mind and senses, including our sense of wonder, is engaged, we can better feel our connection to things that are larger than us. we can better feel our kinship with other beings. In being present to our gratitude, we acknowledge the sufficiency of our own lives and increase our capacity for generosity. In rejoicing, we find a voice to witness for all that is good in this world and all that still needs healing. To make this world a better place, we must make every moment a better moment by inhabiting it with our whole hearts. The path I want to carve through life is one where I'm motivated by love, not fear, in everything I do. When I pick up trash, when I call my senator, I want to be motivated by love of something rather than anger or fear. Yes, feel the fear, feel the anger, don't deny it, but move with love. I think, or does it make a difference if the results are the same? I think it does. For my soul, for my spirit, call it whatever. To live this way, I must be clear about what I love. I must claim it. We often speak of the imperfections of the world in general terms, those things we can't control, like the weather or a traffic jam. We say the world is imperfect because it is made up of imperfect people, and then we cite our quirks, crooked nose, big feet, always being late. I think the real imperfection of this world comes from the fact that we all love imperfectly, and we find it difficult to forgive ourselves and each other for that. If most people are really doing the best they can most of the time, is this the best world we can expect to have? Maybe so, at least for now. Does it mean letting people trample all over other people's rights or never holding them accountable for what they do or never expecting them to grow? Brené Brown says absolutely not. The most compassionate people, she found in her research, also have the most well-defined and well-respected boundaries. Compassionate people know where and when to draw lines. And in doing so, they keep themselves free of resentment and self-righteousness. Resentment and self-righteousness are our true enemies, because if we're not careful, they fester into hate. And none of us is exempt from that possibility. I've kept that little book, The Language of Love, on my bookshelf all these years without questioning why. I almost never looked into it. I can only think that I held on to it in an effort to hold on to something I knew I'd lost about myself and hope to recover one day, like a message from younger me to someday me. And look how handy it came in today. At 16, I was leaving behind my childhood, a time for the most part before I had any notions of dividing people into us versus them, a time when I still believed the whole world was worthy of love. When I was a child, meanness confused me. Strangely, I noticed the feeling I have now about meanness is closer to confusion than the fear or anger I used to feel. It's as if I've regained my beginner's mind in some way. Emmett Fox, as it turns out, was a New Thought spiritual leader of the early 20th century. And as you might expect nowadays, there's a whole website devoted to his teachings and writings. I think those words that I found so inspiring in my teens are still relevant and true. But that comprehensive list of all the things love has the power to bring about now seems overly detailed, like it's trying too hard to cover everything. And it's so relentlessly positive that it doesn't address the risks, the pitfalls we can tumble into if we don't watch out. So now I turn to Rumi for some butt-kicking straight talk. Gamble everything for love if you are a true human being. If not, leave this gathering. Half-heartedness doesn't reach into majesty. You set out to find God, but then you keep stopping for long periods at mean-spirited roadhouses. No, mean-spirited roadhouses are not good places to hang out. I don't want to hang out there. If I look beneath my fear and anger to find what I love, There's a chance I'll have no excuse to stoke my rage into an inferno of pleasing dimensions. If I listen closely and deeply to someone without interrupting, there's a chance I won't get to air my own views right then. If I listen closely and deeply to someone who has a challenging message for me about my own behavior, there's a chance I might have to adjust my self-image if I find a hint of truth in what they say. If I trust that everyone, even me, is doing the best they can, there's a chance I might have to consider a more charitable explanation for someone's behavior, or move on from a situation I can never change. There's a chance that even if I give all I can possibly give to protect something I love, efficient evil may yet destroy it, and that's heartbreaking. If we gamble, there's a chance we'll never gain the outcome we want. But there's also the chance that we might learn something about ourselves that will help us become even more loving, empathetic, and compassionate. Are you looking for work? Have you ever considered becoming a professional gambler for love? Thanks for listening.